Okey-dokey. Good morning, everybody. This is KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Coming up here is the Westburn Naturalist Hour with myself, Seamus, Dallas, and Liz. We are happy to be back in the studio. Liz, I know you got a quick message for us, so let me get you in here. Tell the world what they need to know.
They need to know about King Floyd's Bar Provisions. KWMR is sponsored by King Floyd's Bar Provisions, offering a large variety of artisanal cocktail bitters and their newest item, bitters and soda in two flavors, inspired by the legends of San Francisco's Barbary Coast. King Floyd's can be found in several West Marin locations. Recipes and more can be found at kingfloyds.com. And KWMR is supported by the Bolinas Film Festival, an annual festival celebrating the art of cinema, spotlighting local and international films. This local nonprofit also offers year-round screenings and events, educational programs, and more. Details can be found at bolinasfilm.com.
Nice. All right. Well, let me play a little intro made by yours truly, and we will get to the show in a second. Well, here we are in the studio, Westburn Naturalist Hour, where the magic happens, and it's going to be a magical morning. Good morning, Dallas and Liz. How are you both doing?
Good morning.
Yeah. So I'm excited about this one. I know we've been wanting to talk about this topic since we started the show 6 years ago.
Absolutely, right? Before we jump into that, let's talk a little bit about weather and tides. So it looks like for this next upcoming week, it looks like a relatively cool week. Highs in the low 60s all through the week, with maybe, it looks like a little bit, one high on Thursday of 68 degrees. So get outside and enjoy it on Thursday. Lows are going to be low 50s. And as far as tides for Marshall, California, our next low tide is 0.6 feet at 11:14 a.m. And our next high tide is going to be 5.1 at 5:47 p.m.
It's nice getting that air conditioner of the coast, especially when a lot of the country is in a massive heat wave.
I know a lot of people come out here to the water. They're like, oh, ready for the summer. I'm like, bring your jacket. Let's pass it off to Liz and introduce today's guests.
Thank you. Today's guests are the authors of The Radiant Sea, Color and Light in the Underwater World, Stephen Haddock and Sonka, I'm going to probably pronounce that wrong, Johnson.
Yes.
We are so excited to have you both on the show. You both, are professors and just have these really rich backgrounds that I could have dove into. But yeah,
we'll stoked to spend the whole show
exactly just
background.
Like, wow, how did and then what happened? Really excited to have you both on the show today to talk a bit about your new book and a little bit about bioluminescence. Dallas and I were out last night to see the bioluminescence on Tamales Bay, and it was incredible.
It
was a really beautiful night.
Yeah, you know, it gets dark pretty late this time of year, so we had a pretty late night, so we're still just kind of getting moving.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the show, you both. How's it going?
It's going well.
It's going great. Can you hear us okay?
I hear you. Oh, actually, very, very clear. Sounds like you're using some nice mics,
Nice technology, yeah.
Just the laptop.
All right. Well, yeah, great to join us. We've been wanting to talk about bioluminescence for years, and you know, your new book is absolutely beautiful. So
yeah.
We're so excited to be able to get you on
Thanks.
Here.
Thank you.
Let's, you know, for listeners who haven't picked up the book, you know, can you tell us a little bit about, like, about the book and what drew you guys to start in the book?
Sure. This is Steve. I can start. We sort of, about 10 years ago, we were hanging out and had a brainstorm that we should probably write a book just to help share the kinds of things that we get to see during our research and during, you know, our field work and everything. And we wanted to, I guess, trick people into engaging in the science by having like a pretty picture on one side and then a caption, you know, that describes the scientific stuff.
Oh, I like that.
Behind it, which is really Sanka's specialty. So we had an opportunity about a year ago that came up, to put together this coffee table book, and we started collating pictures and writing captions and then the introductory essays, but maybe Sanka could talk about how we decided to organize the material.
So one wonderful thing about the open ocean is that, well, maybe not so wonderful for the animals that live there, but it's really hard to deal with predation. There's just nowhere you can go, nowhere you can hide. Like, you know, you can't just like duck under your desk or something like that. You know, you're just out there. And so you have to, you know, either look like water to hide or use, you know, other aspects of optics to make yourself really obvious. And because of that, it's sort of like a natural physics laboratory, in that just about anything that can happen with a piece of matter and light, these animals do. And so we wanted to divide the book in that way. You know, light can go through an object. It can go through an object and some of that light's taken away. It can go into the object, some light's taken away, and a different light comes back out. It can make the light. We can bounce the light off in a shiny way. And so we really, and as Steve said, it's really kind of a stealth book because, you know, it's this pretty coffee table book, but we're trying to get across like a fair bit of physics and deep sea biology in the process. And one of the ways is the way we sort of divide up the animal world by these different physical principles of how they manipulate light.
Nice. And we're talking about environments, deep sea, where you don't really get much natural light at all, if any, correct?
It varies. Yeah. I mean, some of the animals we work with are more shallow, but mostly they're deep, or we're interested in what's going on at night.
Okay.
And the book starts at the surface, and it's not exclusively deep sea. So we start at the surface where transparency is really important, and where pigmentation, you know, has potentially a slightly different function than it would down as you go deeper.
Interesting. So is talking about transparency of like the skin of a lot of these creatures, is that more common to have transparent skin closer to where there's light towards the surface than it is deeper down, or is there a correlation there?
I mean, I would say so. In fact, some animals, as they get deeper, being transparent isn't actually the best solution. You'd sort of think it always would be the best solution. But if you've ever wandered around at night with a flashlight and you point it at a window, the window's transparent, but you see the flashlight coming back at you. You know, you get that reflection. And so as you get deeper, transparency becomes less useful because they're dealing with directed bioluminescence and things of that sort. But yeah, mostly you see it up, you know, in the shallower waters. And it's not just the skin. I mean, that's the biggest thing is to be transparent, you got to do it all. You know, you can't just have transparent skin. You got to have transparent muscle. You got to have transparent nerves. You got to have a transparent brain, ideally. And
it's crazy
so
to think about.
It's a whole body solution. Yeah. It's pretty rough, right?
Yeah.
You know, most of the other things you can do with your surface, but transparency is a real whole body commitment.
like jellyfish.
And not everything can be transparent, right? If your eyes are transparent, then they're not absorbing light, so they're not functioning. Mm. So, you know, you see a lot of animals where their eyes, they have a different strategy for making their eyes inconspicuous, like mirrored surfaces or even bioluminescent organs.
Yeah, the one Liz just mentioned, one of the transparent species that comes to mind is the jellyfish, like, you know, like the moon jellies and things like that, close to the surface. Mm-hmm. Let's get into some.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the photos you got. You know, because like bioluminescence is so elusive. You know, so like seeing all these photos, we've been guiding out here for almost 2 decades, and we just got bioluminescence on video like this a few months ago.
Yeah, you know, came out great. By the way.
Yeah, it did totally. But even then, nothing like the photos you guys got. So I was so impressed. Can you guys talk a little bit about like the process of like getting those photos?
Well, I think we're all beneficiaries from the technological advances.
Totally. Like
now you can film bioluminescence on your phone. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago in the lab, we just had these grainy black and white intensified videos that we had to do, you know, 640 by 480 instead of 4K full color. Mm-hmm. So we're all scientifically and just, you know, kind of as a society benefiting from these really amazing cameras that are becoming available.
Yeah,
so it's part of it is that. Yeah. But
and what are you guys like?
It's also on top of that. I mean, it's amazing. Steve and I are still friends. It could take a lot of shots to get a decent shot of bioluminescence.
Totally.
And sometimes it takes a couple of different people because one is, you know, agitating the animal and trying to keep it in the field of view in the dark, mm-hmm. while the other person is, you know, taking the picture and often shining a red LED very briefly to sort of illuminate the rest of the animal. Right. And all of those things have to line up perfectly. And often you're stuffed in what basically looks like the back of a truck, like a semi trailer bolted to the back deck of a ship. And it can be kind of a little bit hot and gross. And you're in there, you know, fighting to get that good picture, which could be like one or two pictures out of many dozens.
Yeah.
And there's always like, here's the perfect moment. And then like you forget to push the button and then the other person yells at you because you didn't push the button in time. And
so, do you want to talk more about what trip?
It can be, there have been some moments where because I couldn't deal with the two of us trying to get a good, it is a challenge, but yeah, I mean what was originally called, I guess the prosumer movement where, you know, Nikon and, you know, Canon started to make really nice low light cameras. And then that spread to iPhones and everything else. Has made so much possible that wasn't possible before.
Yeah, it's only like the last literally month or two I've been telling people on the water at night where it's like, if you have one of the newest phones, you might be able to, you know, take pictures of the bioluminescence. Whereas before it's like, cool. No, there's not a chance. You know,
I know, I've discouraged people left and right.
Exactly.
Like, don't bring your phone.
And then their flash goes off.
I know.
Yeah.
Love that.
That's the worst, right? Yeah.
When we talk about bioluminescence, can we define the terms? Yeah. What we mean by bioluminescence?
For folks who haven't seen it or experienced it.
Well, there's a two-part question that, and the second one I've been kind of burning to ask you. Is it the same throughout all the different species, like the same chemical process when we talk about bioluminescence through all different species?
So bioluminescence is a chemical reaction that releases energy in the form of photons that's happening inside living tissue. And that applies to fireflies. It applies to the dinoflagellates that you guys see. Mm-hmm. A lot of people assume that it's bacterial. Like when they see an animal, they think it's glowing bacteria inside of them. Hmm. But that's actually pretty rare to have these symbiosis. Like in the anglerfish, the little lure is filled with bacteria. But otherwise,
it is. I didn't know that. Huh?
Yeah. Otherwise, most of the animals in the ocean are making their own light. And like you alluded to, the chemicals that they use are not all different. There's some surprising links where two totally unrelated animals use the same chemical to make their light. But in general, it's a totally different chemical in bacteria and dinoflagellates, fireflies, jellyfish. They all have a different light emitting chemical.
So wow. Okay.
It's evolved like probably about 100 times, you know, across the tree of life.
But wow. The funny thing about it is it's like there's two main chemicals. One is like we'll call it like the substrate, the small molecule, and then the other is an enzyme that helps move it along. There aren't that many. That's what Steve was kind of alluding to. Despite all these different evolutions, there aren't that many different substrates. I don't know what the latest count is, Steve. What is it, like 7, 9, something like that?
Yeah, in the ocean. Well, there's one in the ocean that is used by everything from single-celled organisms, radiolarians, to squid, jellyfish, fish, shrimp, worms. Like, there's this whole group that use the same light emitter, the same, it's called a luciferin, the same molecule. Yep. And one thing we found was that some of them are getting it from their diet. So if they don't eat something bioluminescent, they lose the ability to glow themselves, which is kind of an interesting evolutionary thing. If you think about, like, I'm dependent on this, you know, for my survival, and yet I am dependent on this capability, but I'm also dependent on eating some other animal that's actually providing me the chemicals to make that light.
Hmm. Interesting.
So there's a lot of weird connections going on.
It's kind of like a vitamin for light.
A vitamin for light.
Vitamin L or something. You got to get it out of someone else.
Yeah.
I know there's a shark that was bioluminescent after eating bioluminescent coral, and I hadn't done any more research to know if that, like, if it was utilizing that or if it just ended up being like as an extra add-on.
I don't know about that one. There's a lot of in the media, there's a lot of confusion and between fluorescence and bioluminescence. Mm. Mm. And people talk about things glowing.
Totally.
And I dare say the word biofluorescence people sometimes say, which, as you can imagine, is super confusing because it's like, is that bioluminescence or is that fluorescence or what? So fluorescence is a different phenomenon that's in a lot of corals. And there's the skin of a shark that they said was fluorescent, but actually our skin and fingernails and everything is fluorescent as well.
Oh,
so
okay. Well,
I'm not sure.
I learned something new about myself
the
today.
The origin that report.
Right.
You shine the right lights on yourself and look at it through the right filters, you glow.
Yeah.
But you're not actually glowing. I mean, in fact, you're taking light away. Fluorescence always takes light away, but it gives a little bit back.
Okay.
And you know, at a different wavelength. And so if you take a picture of it right, it looks like it's glowing on its own like bioluminescence, but it never is. It's just giving a little bit of light back that it mostly took.
Well, I just learned that humans glow.
Yeah, right.
I mean, Amanda did tell me I was glowing this morning, so I already knew that.
Oh, man, so many questions. This is great. I by the way, I did not realize that bioluminescence has evolved like 100 times. And so a follow-up to that, since it evolved so much, like how much – what do you know any sort of idea like what percentage of the ocean species – use bioluminescence in some strategy or another? Like how many species in the ocean actually bioluminesce, or what percentage is it even known?
We did a study from our, so we have things called ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, that are a pretty important character in this story because that allows us to get these animals in really good condition in order to, you know, take their bioluminescence pictures. So we do a lot of dives with ROVs. We count all the animals that we see on the video. And we did a study of like how many of those are bioluminescent, and it was about 75%, 76%. And this was the same from the surface, you know, the shallowest few dozens of meters all the way down to 4,000 meters.
Same percentage? Same
percentage,
wow,
yeah,
no
throughout
kidding.
The water column. We did a similar study with the benthic thing. So that's things that are in the water column swimming around. The benthic organisms was more around 40%, the low 40s. So that's not to say everything, because there's microbes and there's things that we can't see with the ROV, but of the things that we could see with the ROV, quite a few of them were bioluminescent all the way down.
Wow. I guess it makes you think that it's a strategy much more common than people realize in nature, mm-hmm. especially in the oceans.
So why?
Why?
Dun, dun,
that's
dun.
The question.
The $1 million question.
I mean, yeah, for some of the things, we just have little just-so stories, I like to call them, that we make up, like how the leopard got its spots, how the anglerfish got its glow. But most of them are defensive, I think. Most of the functions are defensive. There's a few things that use it to attract prey. Mm-hmm. There's even fewer that we know that use it to attract mates, like fireflies do. But there's got to be a whole bunch of functions that we just don't know about, because you can't observe them without disturbing them, and they don't do it like in captivity or whatever. what I always find amazing is, like, in a squid, for example, they can be using bioluminescence for like three different functions in one animal. So they'll have camouflage, they'll have a defensive flash, they'll be hiding the silhouette of their eyes and their body, and then they'll also have lights on their tentacles that they'll twinkle to presumably attract prey. So one animal can have many functions.
Yeah. In terms of the... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, like Steve said, you know, we're still trying to figure out all the uses, but it's worth sort of noting that it's amazing habitat for using light of that sort, because, you know, not only is it very dark, you know, externally dark, even compared to, like, you know, a moonless night on land, but there's not much in between you and whatever you're glowing at. And so it can put out a signal if, you know, if it so chooses, for a decent distance. You know, one time just for fun, we put a little dim blue LED in a thing at the bottom of the ocean. And then we were slowly rising up in a submarine, pointing the camera at it to see, you know, how far away we could still see this little blue LED. And it wasn't a bright thing at all. Yeah. We were at least 100 meters off the bottom. It could still see it just fine. The water down there can be quite clear compared to, like, when you jump into the surf, let's say, off of California.
Yeah. Wow. And I think also the dinoflagellates that you guys see, they're, say, less than a millimeter long, and they're communicating to you at a distance, you know, many, many body lengths away. And I did a calculation. It's like for a person communicating to somebody at the top of a mountain, like, you know, 10 kilometers away.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I never really thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
It's such a powerful way for something that tiny. There's no other way that they could get a message through to something much larger and far away other than using light. It's chemical, sound. You know, the other types of senses or signals that they could produce is they're just so much less powerful.
It's the same scale as someone communicating to someone else on the top of a mountain, like these little signals that are organisms to the person be able to see it. That's wild.
No. Yeah, it's a bit like stars on a dark night. You know, you could never see a tiny black dot of a bird from any real distance. But if you have a light on a black background, you can see it from a tremendous distance, as long as the medium in between you and it is fairly clear, which the deep sea is.
Yeah.
So they get some real advantages that you just don't see with other forms of signaling or however else they want to be using it.
Yeah. Wow. Follow-up question there. So you mentioned the dinoflagellates we get in Tomales Bay. And correct us if I'm wrong, because we've learned over the years that it's thought that it's a theory why they light up is a burglar alarm theory, where something larger up the food chain kind of eats the predators that are eating it, and that's what the light signal is for. Does that sound correct with the little critters we get in Tomales Bay here?
Yeah, there's been two lines of experiments that have looked at why the little dinoflagellates flash. One of them is, like you said, the burglar alarm. And we've actually done some lab experiments where you put a bunch of dinos in the tank, and then you have a prey item, like a shrimp swimming through, and then you put a predator, like a cuttlefish or a fish in there. And it leaves a visible trail. The shrimp leaves a totally visible trail of light behind it, and in complete darkness the cuttlefish can find that shrimp. So it makes it super dangerous for you to exist in that environment where all these dinos are flashing. So burglar alarm, I think, definitely is one. But even direct, there's been some evidence of, like, when a small organism like a copepod, which is like little bugs of the sea, if they grab a dino and it flashes, they sometimes will reject it. They'll just be stunned by it and they'll drop it.
Oh,
And so there's another more direct anti-predator function that is thought to serve for dinos.
Oh, interesting. And I suppose you can hold both of these as being true or strategies that can be employed.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's kind of like eating a cheeseburger and all of a sudden it blasts out a bunch of light. You might drop the thing. Except for them, they also have to worry about the fact they're dark adapted and that light could actually temporarily, you know,
what if that would be
startling for blind them temporarily?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That'd probably be my reaction if I ate a glowing cheeseburger. Maybe. I don't know.
I think you'd keep eating it.
Probably.
Well, glows are supposedly attract and flashes deter. So that's why the anglerfish can get away with it. So a long, steady signal, things are like, huh, what's that over there? I'm going to go check that out. And then a flash is a sudden deterrent. So that's kind of the rule of thumb for
some of these displays. Huh.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Whoa, you guys are blowing our minds here already. This is great.
There's so many questions, like what direction to take it, you know?
Yeah. Scrap the outline. What do you guys want to talk about?
Yeah, we typically go out on dark nights, moonless nights. Do you guys see more activity when it's on new moons or just any dark nights on the surface with bioluminescent creatures?
What do you say, Sanka?
I mean, you know, mostly, you know, we work deeper where, you know, you're not going to see a difference. It's just dark. But when I've looked at things from the surface like that, I personally haven't. But, you know, I'm only looking at a couple of different bioluminescent animals. I mean, one of the neatest things we saw, which was actually on a full moon night, was there was a huge thunderstorm on a small island, just a little coral blob in the middle of the Belize Barrier Reef. Huge thunderstorm with all this lightning flying everywhere. And every time the lightning went off, all the ostracots sitting down in the reef flat in front of us would flash back. So it's kind of like this guy talking to the sea god or whatever. It was amazing.
Oh, wow.
And in that case, yeah, there was tons of light. Other times where it's been really dark, you know, see it too. I don't know. I haven't noticed a big difference. But we're mostly keepers. I don't know. Steve, do you see a difference?
Well, I think there's two things going on. One is that it's way easier to see the bioluminescence on a new moon.
Yeah.
You know, when there's no moon up, it's not competing with it, and you're going to see it a lot better. So I would even, for, you know, your tours, you probably encourage people to come depending on the moon.
Yeah,
we only do them on moonless nights. But, you know, on new moons, we typically will see, like, sometimes polychaete worms will come up, and you see, like, bioluminescent spawning. So we see more random things that are bioluminescent on moon nights, on new moons, rather than just, like, occasional slivers of dark.
Well, the other thing... No, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what Dallas is getting at here is that, like, our tours are short, right? So they're only for a few hours in that window of darkness right after sunset. So that's like 2 weeks each month that we can get out and see this. But on the new moon night specifically, where the moon's not going to come out at all that evening, we do tend to see like kind of more quirky things happening than just like cool bioluminescence.
The other factor I think might be vertical migration. So things they'll go down during the day and they'll come up at night. And they're kind of maintaining a constant light level to some extent. So they'll go down in the day until they're deep enough to be in like dark water where they feel comfortable. And if the moon is up, they won't come as shallow as they would if there's no moon. They'll just come up until it starts getting bright. Yeah, so I think that might also have something to do with just the abundance of organisms that are right near the surface.
Because, a full moon, in addition to being much, much brighter than no moon, it's also up for the entire night.
Right.
Because of just the geometry of the problem. And so, yeah, there's going to be a sort of a depression of that upper limit of vertical migration for pretty much the whole time. So, yeah, full moons have a real effect on lighting. We just don't appreciate it because we live in such a technological world.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were the periods, you know, the few days around a full moon where everybody could walk to the next town and, you know, have a big social event or a dance or a party or, we noticed that we live out on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and it's almost intrusive how bright the full moon is when it comes.
Tell me about it.
You feel like you're being watched because the difference is very large, and of course it lasts all night, whereas, you know, a half moon or whatever is only half the night, and smaller moons than that are even shorter periods of night. So the total amount of illumination really shoots up around a full moon.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting, the concept of vertical migration and where the moon's at. I never thought about
totally
that.
Answers that question.
Yeah. One more question. We've got to get to a break here soon. And this might be a question to answer after the break. We'll see. Because you mentioned also in a lot of your book, there's the bioluminescence element of it, but then there's also like the fluorescence or the translucence of the skin in a lot of these species. Is there an easy correlation between bioluminescence and like translucent skin, or is it kind of all over the map in terms of like strategies of having these two factors?
I mean, we can get into it in depth. I would say it's all over the map because some of the most opaque things are the black fish that Sanka has has worked on the ultra black fish that are also super bioluminescent in many cases, and there's reds and, you know, everything in between. So it kind of everybody seems to take advantage of bioluminescence, yeah. whether they have a transparent or an opaque strategy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's nice. Sort of a crazy mix and match. I mean, for real individual species, maybe you could start to put together some kind of a story as to what's going on, but it's also a story.
Yeah.
Because we just don't get to observe them acting naturally. You know, so much of what we do is like forensic biology. You know, we're trying to figure it out after the fact based on reasoning and what we can't see. Because the second we go down there, we disturb everything.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of a conundrum, huh? The observation element is going to change the behavior and like lighting, right? Or of what's going on for what you're observing. So it's hard to capture what's happening in, I guess, in an environment where you're not putting yourself in there to affect it.
Yeah. The amount of light that we put into the environment, even scuba diving, but especially with our ROVs, with our subs, is, you know, thousands and thousands of times what they would ever experience. So we have red lights and other tricks to try to go around being a little bit less intrusive, but you're never going to get the full.
Yeah. Like, interesting. That is it.
Yeah. It's very quantum mechanical. You know, you can use all of your gadgets to find out where the animal is, but it's not behaving remotely like it ever would have by that point. You know,
interesting.
By the time you see it, it's probably seen you for quite some time.
Yeah.
Driving up with an ROV or whatever, because you're coming in like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right? With the, you know, lights and the sound and everything else.
That is an interesting factor I hadn't thought about in observing a lot of these especially deep sea creatures. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Well, we do have to take a quick break here. We have a message for the world.
Yeah, two of them.
We got two of them. All right.
Well, three of them. Okay. Because you're listening to the West Marin Naturalist Hour on KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 in Bolinas, and 92.3 in the San Geronimo Valley.
Yes.
And KWMR is underwritten by Marin Symphony, presenting live classical music concerts each fall through spring. Chamber performances are held at various venues throughout Marin County. More information at marinsymphony.org or by phone, 415-479-8100. And the...
Wait for it.
KWMR is also supported by the Petaluma Music Festival, presenting 10,000 Maniacs, the Smithereens, and many more at the Petaluma Fairgrounds on Saturday, July 25th. Proceeds benefit music education programs in all Petaluma area public schools. Tickets are available now at PetalumaMusicFestival.org.
Nice. And we're going to take a quick break. If you're just tuning in, this show's amazing, about bioluminescence. And we are with a couple of wonderful folks talking about their book Radiant of the Sea. I know there's a request for a song. We're gonna play a little Courtney Love, Violet. We're gonna rock out here, and we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
Are you in your office? All the stars are just like little fish. You should learn when to go. You should learn how to say no.
One above and one below.
Okie dokie, we are back. This is the Westboro Naturalist Hour, and we are talking about Radiant of the Sea. And
the Radiant Sea.
I was going to say.
That was going to be what I said next.
Oh, okay.
Yes. We have so many questions.
I think we want to talk a little bit about, if you could tell us a little more about like what an expedition looks like to do your research and get these photos, because it sounds like a lot goes into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think not only has the technology of capturing the images kind of affected how well we can share these with people, but also we both have had the chance to collect organisms in like super pristine shape. So historically, people would drag a big net through the water. It's basically like a sieve. Mm-hmm. Come up with this kind of soup of animals from the deep, and they would all have been sitting in this net for a couple hours, doing all their flashing and glowing. But we can go down with submarine or with scuba diving, collect something into a jar, like undisturbed, basically, except for the light that we're shining on it. Mm-hmm. And I think a big advantage, like we don't really have any dead animals in the book. A lot of the photo books for the deep sea that you see, like as a biologist, when you look at it, it's kind of horrifying. There's like their jaws are falling off, their scales, their eyes are milky white. Aww. They're obviously dead animals, and they just like take a picture of it and say, hey, this is what the deep sea looks like. So people get this very offensive picture of how gruesome, the animals are. And we're lucky enough to be able to collect them in super good shape, show them what they really look like, and then also see their bioluminescent behaviors. So for your question, Sanka was just out on a really long cruise. We just got back from a 10-day cruise. Tomorrow I'm going out for a 1-day cruise. There's kind of different flavors of trips that we do, but usually it's going out on a ship and then either having a submersible that we can go do a dive down and collect organisms, or sometimes it's a scuba focused expedition where we just do what's called blue water dives, and we do these open ocean dives to collect things. Sanka wrote a whole book basically about spending time on a boat with other people in the middle of the ocean. It's an adventure, but it's a fun way to spend some of your time.
Yeah, because in many cases you're crammed with these same 20 to 30 people for maybe a month at a time. And maybe you see one other boat at a distance and no land. Wow. During the whole period. So you become very, in an ideal world, dependent on each other and fond of each other. In a less ideal world, you start to get kind of sick of each other. And we try to recreate our labs that are on shore at sea. And so we do our very best. And because both Steve and I do a lot of dark work, we take a normal shipboard laboratory and carve it up essentially using hefty plastic. We have to create all these like portable instantaneous dark rooms, And so the whole room might just be carved up into weird little hefty bags in a way.
Oh, wow.
To let us do, you know, dark work on vision or bioluminescence or photography and so on. So, yeah, you're trying to recreate like a university lab on, you know, a crazy rolling ship in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Well, this, at a time.
This sounds like it'd make a great reality TV show, too.
Well, they have Deadliest
Below
Catch.
Deck. It's like Below Deck meets Deadliest Catch.
Yeah. Pretty much, right? Yeah.
The glowiest catch.
And a burning question I have, too, is what are some of the applications that your research has informed? And I know this is a big question as well, which we'll probably spend a whole show on. But I know bioluminescence is used in like the medical profession, and someone was even telling me there's research on bioluminescent trees, you know, to replace street lamps. So, anyways, is there any like anything your research is informing
There are things that, you know, surprise you a little down the road. I mean, that's probably one of the greatest thing about this sort of more, call it curiosity-driven research, is that it can impinge on very practical things.
Sure.
So, you know, I started out doing a lot of work on transparent animals, and it turns out what I learned from that, and particularly the math and physics of how to study that, was very useful for understanding cataracts. Oh. So I started working with, you know, medical groups to understand like the changes in lenses as we get older and which ones really matter for, you know, messing up our vision and which don't. And for the ultra black fish, that has mostly been picked up by engineers, because it turns out a lot of different optical engineers need a black surface. They need them inside cameras. They need them inside satellites. They need them inside all kinds of optical measuring things and so on. They need ways of making light go away. And they end up reading and citing that work actually a lot more than biologists.
Hmm. Wow. No kidding.
It's neat because Sanka's, like, we kind of overlap with the five topics in the book of transparency, pigmentation, iridescence, which we haven't really talked about, but it's really fun, bioluminescence, fluorescence. And Sanka's translational research, I think, has been in the iridescence is actually, believe it or not, the ultra black fish are a form of structural coloration, if I've got that right. Mm-hmm. So transparency and the structural colors based on the properties of the molecules is Sanka's translational research. Mine is really in the bioluminescence and fluorescence end of things. And so the same genes that can give an organism these really bright fluorescent proteins can be put into other organisms or used in the lab to make things glow where you want them to glow. So, I mean, one example is like you're studying cancer. You want to know, is this tumor growing or shrinking under this treatment? Instead of having to dissect open like a mouse or something, look inside of it and see the size of the tumor, you make the tumor glow. And then you can just visualize it inside the living animal and see its changes over time. So it's a really powerful way for the animals to use it in the environment, but it's also incredibly powerful in the lab.
Yeah.
And the example that we always trot out is that the original research on bioluminescent jellyfish, it revealed not only the first photoprotein, the first light emitting sort of protein system, but also green fluorescent protein. And then that went on to win the Nobel Prize for the researchers. So I always like to say that a jellyfish won the Nobel Prize because of its contributions to science. And yet those researchers couldn't get funding because it was like, oh, that's nice. You know, like we don't see what the importance of that is. Those people who made the original discoveries could not get funding for their research after that because people were so application driven. And they couldn't make the connection. So
I
think it's
always so fascinating to me. And it feels like this has happened time and time again, where it's like technology develops from like just the scientific pursuit out of curiosity and, you know, for the sake of knowledge. And then what stems from that is all sorts of useful technologies rather than vice versa, right? It's like you're kind of opening possibilities by.
Yeah, that's rarer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, a good example is the laser. So the laser, which was a conversion of doing it in the microwave world, basically when it was invented, call it for fun, you know, to see if they could do it. And they said maybe someday there'll be a use for this. And probably looking around either your office or your home, there's not much that either doesn't have a laser inside it or somehow had a laser involved in its manufacture. Yeah. You know, they're completely ubiquitous technology now. We don't appreciate it. So, yeah, every now and then, you know, Blue Sky Research hits a massive home run in terms of its translational abilities. And one last thing about optics is anything that you figure out having to do with light pretty much usually works for microwaves, for the frequencies that work for your cell phones, for sound, for radar, for ultraviolet, for all those different things. And so, you know, even if you want to worry about like the tile in a recording studio to reduce echoes, what we figured out for ultra black skin in the fish in the deep can be applied to make, you know, tiles that don't make echoes inside your studio.
Oh, wow. Huh. I'm trying to understand the correlation there. That's fascinating.
It's all waves, what it comes down to.
Yeah.
It's all understanding what matter does to waves.
Yeah.
Wow. So if you learn it for one wave, you've learned it for all waves.
Yeah. That's really cool.
That's so interesting. And to think about that, I'm guessing that wasn't that long ago that we first started doing the research on bioluminescence. Theoretically speaking, in the 60s?
1660s.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Cool. What was the first research on it?
I mean, the first research was probably, there's a, like Pliny the Elder, there's people poking jellyfish with a stick.
Yeah, go way back.
But a lot of the experiments with oxygen, figuring out the oxygen dependence on, for bioluminescence were done actually in, I think, the late 1600s.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, people have been fascinated with it for centuries. I think there are a couple revolutions. The genetic revolution really changed things. Because even that original jellyfish research that I was talking about, they would collect like 50,000 jellyfish, cut the rings off, put them through these purification systems and try to get the proteins and the chemicals involved in light. Oh. And now we can collect a single deep sea organism, sequence its genome, and figure out a whole bunch about how it's making light just from one individual. Mm-hmm. And that's all because our ability to like clone and sequence genes and genomes.
Yeah.
So I think that's had a big effect on our advances.
Yeah, they didn't have that in the 1600s, huh?
You just had to poke a jellyfish with a stick. See, that's how the science starts. So I'm not sure if you can have any input on this, but this is a topic of curiosity out here locally. So we get bioluminescence, which it seems like the trend has been with these dinoflagellates. It's a little bit more of a year-round phenomena, maybe because of changing ocean conditions, warmer temperatures.
Or are we just looking for them?
Are we just looking for them more? I was curious if that is maybe a global or regional trend of more of the stuff being more, because it's like an algae bloom, right? And so I'm wondering if there's any global climactic changes that are informing that.
I mean, I think the we're just looking for them aspect of everything is really, you know, with social media, you hear about a bioluminescent event or a jellyfish bloom, you know, or a Vilela washup. You hear about them no matter where they happened, whereas before that would have been just local or regional knowledge.
Yep.
So I think that's a big part of it. But also, I think a lot of these blooms are dependent on nutrient influx into the environment. And so that could certainly be changing with agricultural practice and things like that. And I think they also set up more... They'll be more persistent if they're not mixed down. So if you have an influx of nutrients, say a windy event that brings up nutrients or rains, and then you have a calm period, then that allows that surface layer that makes for the really dramatic displays to kind of stabilize and not just get mixed down into the water column.
And that's what we've noticed. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, your bay is an interesting structure.
Right.
I've been there a couple of times, you know, being this very long, skinny, blind-ended thing without a lot of mixing, you know, from the outside world. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it does allow for that, you know, eventual stabilization where you can have blooms and a lot of bioluminescence. And like Steve said, you're probably having more and more development on the coast, which, you know, whether it's agricultural or residential development, nutrients are going to enter a body of water that doesn't flush very regularly. You know, you're, I mean, to be blunt, it's kind of like a blind-ended toilet. And that, you know, it takes a little bit of work to get water back out of that bay.
That's true. Yeah,
because of its shape and the currents and so on.
Yeah, I think I think he's noticed that water sloshing around at the southern end of the bay can be in there for years, right?
4 months. Four months. Has like that midsection has a 4 month water cycle.
And that's how we describe why it gets so good in there as well. But I was curious if there's any correlation with climate change and some of these blooms hanging around a little more year round.
Yeah, we're starting to see more of the harmful algae blooms all the way through the coast. But again,
I mean, what's amazing to me about the bioluminescence stuff is that you'll get reports from San Diego, you know, like off Scripps, they'll have glowing waves and they'll kind of move up the coast. Like the entire coast seems to get it almost at once sometimes. And to me, that's pretty remarkable that it's not just in one of these enclosed or semi-enclosed situations where.
Yeah. It seems like we get in the ocean when conditions are kind of right. You get the big bloom where it's like, you know, Tomales Bay is more of a consistent, you know, phenomena. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's, I think, characteristic of like the bioluminescent bays in Puerto Rico and Jamaica, you know, the famous ones. They have a very similar kind of incubator setup.
That's great about an incubator setup. your book. We didn't just to touch on a few more elements of your book as we're winding down here. Because some of the elements you talk about in your book we haven't really touched on much yet. But you have the book kind of in six different sections.
Counting the intro,
The intro, and I know some of the fluorescence and iridescence we really haven't
we didn't touch on iridescence. Do you want to quickly kind of talk a little bit about iridescence?
Tsunko, why don't you? Iridescence is really amazing to me, and it's
iridescence is, I don't know, it's like you can make color out of what seems like nothing. I mean, you know, when we think about color, we're usually thinking of like when we first learned about color playing with paints, you know, in kindergarten. And this would be more like if instead of your teacher gave you a bunch of different paints, you know, your teacher gave you like this shellac that you could lay down like in a really, really thin layer and then put another layer of different shellac over it and another one. So everything is clear. But when you look at it, all of a sudden there'd be this beautiful color as you started to build it up. It's light, you know, and color that comes out of the fact that light is a wave phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And that when you make really thin layers of different optical properties, the light within them interacts, the waves interact in what we call constructive and destructive interference, where either the waves add up or they go away, and certain colors of light will add up and other colors of light will go away. And it can make light appear and disappear, you know, almost as if by magic. You know, the common thing we think about, of course, are soap bubble films. And the iridescence you see in a lot of these animals are kind of like taking a soap bubble film to its natural conclusion. You know, instead of just having one little layer, let's say, what if we stacked more and more layers? And that tends to get you a deeper and richer color. But it's the same sort of science underneath it. You take a clear object, and if you make it really small and thin, you can make it play around with color.
I think of it like noise canceling, like Sanka made an analogy before about these tiles, but noise canceling headphones, you know, if you pump in the opposite wave, like you imagine a sine wave, you know, undulating. If you pump in the exact opposite of that wave, it basically cancels it out.
Phase cancellation, so, as we call that.
Exactly.
There you go. So if you do that with light, you can enhance certain wavelengths and suppress certain wavelengths. And so you get these really bright, shiny, almost monochromatic light that comes out from white light shining on the surface.
Wow.
And one of the neatest things is some of the animals can control the spacing of those little layers so they can change iridescent color essentially at will.
You know,
they can decide to make a red structural color all the way to a violet one.
Is that true in what's the big
chameleon?
Chameleon's a good example, but I would say octopuses. Is that true in like octopuses and how they change their...
It's true in cephalopods. So most of the work's been done on squid or cuttlefish, which are, you know, their relatives. And they have a group of structures called iridophores, which just means the iridescent object, basically. Mm-hmm. And they have direct neural control over the spacing in their what we call interference reflectors. They can change the color, like, sort of at will. I mean, their will is, you know, in theory, they could play like an Elvis movie on their back. I mean, they're not going to do that. But, you know, within the parameters of what they would like to do. Octopus, there are some iridophores in octopuses. They tend to be a little more heavy on pigmentation than the squids.
The chameleon.
I know tend to be more. Right. And chameleons are pigment-based. That I know of any.
Yeah. Okay.
Any iridophores in chameleons.
You can sort of tell if it's shiny. You know, shiny or just it looks brighter than the background, then it's potentially iridescence. And pigmentation is subtracting the color out. It's always less than what you're putting in.
It just makes me think that all these different ways of manipulating light. I mean, that's just the large part of the evolutionary story of our ocean is the manipulation of light, right? It's kind of one of the main aspects of your book through the pictures and words so much as trying to story that's trying to tell, right? The manipulation.
Which is really funny when you think about it because sound travels so much better in the ocean than light does. I mean, light travels pretty well at certain wavelengths in a really clear ocean, like blue-green light travel really pretty well. But sound is amazing, but sound production... You know, is not seen on a massive scale. I mean, you know, the whales have it, you know, whales and dolphins and all that, and a few other animals out there. But you don't sort of hear this cacophony of noise when you're scuba diving in the open ocean. Mm-hmm. But you do see all these different optical tricks.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. Well, we do need to wrap up here. How we find your book?
Yeah, where's the best place to buy the book?
I should be able to get it almost anywhere. I know they have.
That's
it
what at... my research showed. Online, anywhere.
It's pretty common.
Yeah.
Is it used a lot in classrooms? Do you know? Or do a lot of teachers have your book on hand? Seems like the educational world it'd make a lot of sense.
I don't know yet, but I did have some emails from people who said they were going to use it in their classroom. Awesome. I donated a copy to our kids' elementary school, and it was really cute to come to pick him up. And then there's these kids like sitting on the floor with the book open, and they're like, for each page, they were flipping to the page, and then each one would point to their favorite picture on the page and then like flip to the next page and say, I like this one, I like that one. So it was really cute to see the engagement from like small to big.
And that's kind of one of the audiences we really hope to get are. Call it like, you know, the 10-year-old dinosaur reader, you know, who gets so fascinated by the pictures, but they also really want
to know
to learn them too. And so that's why we put so much, you know, accessible science in there, you know, along with the pictures to reach those grade school kids in addition to others, you know, to sort of give them an early appreciation for.
And curiosity, right?
Yeah, curiosity for what's out there. Yeah. Because they're not going to see it normally because, you know, nobody just randomly ends up 1,000 meters under the ocean.
I think also the appreciation. I mean, yesterday we having lunch at this place and they had this, you know, the ambient visual stimulus video playing in the background and it was all AI generated fake, supposedly underseen underwater images.
Oh,
and it was just awful. And they were mixing them with like a couple real clips of like a moray eel and then this like fake jellyfish. And I don't know. We really want people to understand that there is like amazing beauty in the ocean, amazing, bizarre creatures that are more alien than you can imagine, but they're not computer generated. And it's an environment worth preserving and worth, you know, understanding.
Awesome.
Because it's not always the perception that's given.
I know we don't really get to experience it on a level we do like in the mountains. Right. So, well, we do need to wrap up. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.